It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Tons to cover.
And, well, that's a surprise, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know.
Yeah, we try from week to week. One of these weeks, we're just going to have, you know, like a couple of items from Washington, D.C., and the rest of it will all be good news of really cool things that people are doing locally, and people will think they found the wrong program.
I'm going to say, I don't have a laugh track ready for that one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's start out as we have for a while now with a local and referendum.
Yes, let's start with good news now that we've said we never have any. Tim Iman failed, went down in flames. Referendum 65, his effort to overturn the gay civil rights bill that was passed by the legislature after 30 years of trying. It was widely expected that he would qualify that initiative, and referendum, and that when he did, it would be very, very difficult to defeat it in November. Well, it's not happening. Iman has been living a for quite a while now. He's failed to qualify four of his last six initiatives. He really doesn't have any kind of statewide organization or independent funding mechanism these days. He's really only got one or two sugar daddies who bankroll his campaigns when they particularly like them, and they weren't really interested in this one because they're primarily interested in anti-tax measures. So Iman really had to rely on the evangelical church movement that is anti-gay, and there he ran into a real split. He was relying on one particular East Side pastor who is very much anti-gay, but who's in something of a power and ego struggle with the Reverend Ken Hutcherson, who's also an East Side evangelical pastor who hates gays. And so the two factions weren't really helping each other. So it all kind of fell between the cracks, and the thing failed. And gays and lesbians and bisexuals and transgenders will continue to have civil rights in the state of Washington for the foreseeable future. It's great news.
All right. Moving along.
Oh, and I should say also there was a lot of positive work by people trying to stop that referendum, and that really contributed to their inability to get signatures for it. So good work to those folks, too.
Very good. Well, the Department of Homeland Security is busy in every state, but it was busy in this state. And actually, it was like a week and a half ago where a decision came down to kick...
Oh, yes. That's actually the immigration people, not Department of Homeland Security. Ibrahim Sheikh Mohammed is a mosque leader in southeast Seattle who's from Somalia. He's been fighting deportation for some time. The U.S. government is basically claiming that he was funneling funds to terrorist organizations in Somalia, which everybody who knows him and everybody who's part of his mosque and part of his community says is patently ridiculous. And oddly enough, they're deporting him to Kenya because that's where they say he's from. Well, he came through Kenya on his way to the United States. He had to because Somalia, as people may remember, particularly from the headlines this week, doesn't really have a functional central government and hasn't for the last 15 years or so. So, and we actually helped in that process in the early 90s. So, so he's, you know, legitimately in the United States, is not particularly a terrorist threat of any kind, but he has given up his fight to stay in the United States. He's been detained, as they say, imprisoned for the last several months, and just doesn't want to continue the struggle anymore. So he's giving up, and he's being shipped out to Kenya. It's really a very sad story.
Mm-hmm. All right, and moving along, the University of Washington Board of Regents has put their foot down.
Yeah, they voted on Thursday in a strong human rights stand that actually is better than not taking the stand, I suppose, to divest themselves of all companies that they have money invested in that do business with the government of the country of Sudan because of the extensive human rights violations in Darfur and many other places in that long-running civil war. Well, it's a very good and very noble stand. Obviously, the amount of money that the University of Washington has invested in companies that do business in the country of Sudan is not very large. But as it turns out, there is one company that does do business in Sudan that UW has money in. That is Royal Dutch Shell. And so we'll see if UW acts on this, and hopefully student groups will follow up and monitor that and pay attention to whether they actually do it. But in the meantime, you know, the next time you fill up your gas tank, remember that Royal Dutch Shell is in the sedan, as well as many other unsavory places. And maybe when you see that Shell sign on the side of the highway, you should just keep on going a little bit. You know, maybe look for a Citgo, which is owned by the country of Venezuela, which their state oil company, which actually puts a lot of their oil profits into money for the poor. Imagine that. So it's a little bit different.
Yeah. Well, Jim McDermott got some headlines this week. Probably the leadership he was looking for.
Yeah, the Center for Public Integrity in D.C. released a study of the travel and junket habits of all of our 535 congresspeople. And for the state of Washington, Jim McDermott was right at the head of the class. He had taken 41 of the 98 trips taken between 1999 and 2005 by Washington state senators and representatives. Nearly, like, you know, more than 40% of the trips taken by representatives in the entire state. And, you know, far outstripping them. On the other hand, nationally, McDermott wasn't even anywhere near the leadership. There were 10 people in the House of Representatives alone that took more than 200 trips. That's even, you know, what, five times more than McDermott took, you know, during that period. So there's a lot of out of control spending going on. But locally, for all the grief McDermott gets about, you know, not doing things for his local district, not getting money for the viaduct or for Seattle transportation or economic development or things like that, he is taking junkets to foreign countries. We can give him credit for that. And, you know, one of those was to Iraq, and that was certainly a worthwhile trip. So.
Well, when you say out of control spending, these aren't trips that were paid for on the tax dollars. It's my understanding they're paid for by outside people.
Some were taxpayers, some were not. The ones that were not are also, you know, you have to look kind of carefully at where those sponsorships are coming from, because a lot of representatives, you know, Tom DeLay, who we'll talk about in a minute, being an obvious example, are getting into real trouble for taking some of those junkets from questionable sponsors. That they then turn around and do favors for legislatively.
Moving along, court news, starting with a local decision.
Yeah, there were several court decisions of interest this week. Locally, we have a judge who in King County, who ordered the Woodinville Tent City to move in 8 days. That just happened yesterday. So the Tent City, which just set up in Woodinville, and this was after a previous court had issued an injunction when the Woodinville City Council had refused permission for the Tent City to come back to Woodinville. It had been there in 2004 previously. So Sharewheel's going to have to find another home on the east side for that Tent City, it looks like, and they're going to have to do it very, very quickly. It's too bad. 64 homeless people in that encampment right now, and they need a new home.
Mm. All right. And the state Supreme Court has weighed in, or is weighing in, with Strange Bedfellows, KVI, and the ACLU.
Yeah, they actually heard a case this week involving KVI Radio, the conservative talk AM station in Seattle. And the ACLU, usually reviled by conservatives, has gone to bat for KVI in this case, and for its talk show hosts, John Carlson and Kirby Wilbur. They have been sued because of their advocacy on the air and their organizing efforts on the air for the initiative last year that would have repealed the gas tax. It had a lot of initial momentum. It got a lot of signatures quickly, got on the ballot, and then ultimately failed. But one of the ways it got signatures very, very quickly was that Carlson and Wilbur were not only promoting it on the air, they were telling listeners where to go to get petitions. They were using the airwaves to essentially to organize. And what the complaint filed with the state election folks claimed was that that was an in-kind donation, and that when broadcast stations, when media take stances on initiatives like that or ballot measures, that they should be required to report in-kind donations. Well, this opens up a whole can of worms, you know, for any publication or radio station. I guess Eat the State would be one of them that actually takes stances and urges action of its audience on ballot measures. So it's kind of an important case, especially if the court rules in favor of the complainants and you know, broadens the scope of it. It could be it could really change how political reporting happens in the state of Washington.
All right. And finally, the U.S. Supreme Court is weighing in or going to potentially weigh in on schools.
Yeah, this actually is a really dangerous case that people need to pay attention to. It comes from the city of Seattle. In fact, the Seattle School District, and it's going to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. They accepted the case this week. It's a major, major test case. And the issue in this case was the use of the Seattle School District of race as a tie-breaking factor, one of several tie-breaking factors, in determining when there were too many students who wanted the same schools as part of the school assignment system that the district had until a few years ago when this court challenge came up and the district put that particular system in abeyance until they got a clear court ruling on it. What may well happen, the last time in an affirmative action case came before the Supreme Court, John Roberts and Samuel Alito were not on the court, and the court, with Sandra Day O'Connor being the swing vote, gave this sort of nuanced half one side, half the other ruling that allowed race to continue to be used as a tie-breaking factor. That may not hold this time. This case from Seattle may in fact open the door to what would effectively be the resegregation of public schools in the United States. It's a very, very worrisome case. Pay attention to it.
All right. Well, moving to national, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is a Sergio Leone film, but
yes.
It also describes what some of the decisions Congress made this week.
Yeah, Congress was really busy this week, and I'll just run through them briefly. Some of them will be familiar for folks, some of them won't. A couple of issues in which Congress was bad this week, both of which I think there have been such alarmist emails floating around for the last 10 years that people aren't taking these issues very seriously, and they should. One of them involved the issue of net neutrality, that is the proposal by big telecommunications companies to allow big companies that pay big users that pay a higher fee, the AOLs and Googles and Yahoos and so forth, to have their websites be accessed quickly by customers, and the small fry, the little blogs, the alternative websites that give you different kinds of news, people with dissenting opinion, will load very slowly, or maybe they won't even load at all if your internet service provider doesn't like what they have to say. That is making its way through Congress. It is a very real threat. An effort to attach an amendment to a bill that would have killed it failed this week in the House by a 269 to 152 vote. That's a major margin. All Republicans and some Democrats voted against it. Keep an eye on that. Also, we had NPR and PBS potentially taking a major hit in their funding. That passed the House Appropriations Committee this week. It'll go to the full House. It'll go to the Senate. The House Appropriations Committee voting to cut $115 million from public broadcasting's 2007 budget. That's 25% of their budget. And that again would take effect in September 2006, in just a few months. So, a major threat to the budget of really for a lot of people, particularly in more rural parts of the country. It's their really only broadcast source of any kind of meaningful news and information in this country, and it would be a terrible thing to lose. We also had Tom DeLay going out in flames this week. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, but Arlen Specter unfortunately deciding that the Senate Judiciary Committee is not going to be able to question phone company executives on the NSA database scandal. That's because Dick Cheney informed Specter that the executives would be prohibited on national security grounds from answering any of his questions. Specter's committee is also interested in having the FBI come and testify on why the FBI wants 50 years of Jack Anderson's papers, the investigative journalist who died a few years ago. And we had also Dick Cheney and his office announcing that they now consider themselves exempt from the yearly requirement to report how Cheney's office uses its power to classify secret information. So they're keeping secret what they keep secret. It's really kind of frightening and secretive. On the good side, we talked about Tom DeLay going down in flames. Not only did he go out swinging, saying a few quite impolitic and rather embarrassing things, but the day before he did that, it was revealed that his wife, Christine DeLay, who has already had a spotlight shine on her for getting $115,000 in particularly unwarranted salary from a guy named Edwin Buckham, who is an associate of Jack Abramoff's, who's already pleaded guilty, a former chief of staff of DeLay. But it turns out that Buckham was also setting up a retirement account for Christine DeLay and putting money into it. It brings the total amount of money that Buckham and Abramoff funneled into Tom DeLay via his wife to over $500,000 for this paragon of Republican virtue. We also had in the category of good news the Senate voting down the constitutional amendment for that would prohibit gay marriage, and they also voted down the estate tax. That failed as well, and there was some question as to whether Maria Cantwell would vote yay or nay, and she wound up voting nay to her credit. So that's good news.
I know the estate tax in Washington is coming up as an issue. Do you think that was in response to that, or that was just something that was running in parallel? The two different efforts, you know.
Yeah, it's such a tricky thing for Washington State because, of course, the state's biggest newspaper, that's like their major political campaign. That's what Frank Bluthen cares about. And so there's a lot of pressure on elected politicians in Washington State to bend that way. And Cantwell did not, to her credit. So it's good for her.
All right. Jumping back to national, there were numerous primaries this week.
Yeah, and some bad news, some good news. Francine Busby lost in her bid as a Democrat to replace Duke Cunningham in California's 50th district. That's a heavily Republican district, and she only lost by 49-45%, so which is way better than a Democrat has done there probably in forever. So that actually wasn't nearly as bad as it sounds. Unfortunately, there was also a very good initiative that failed in California that would have taxed the rich to pay for a universal preschool program, which would have been very good. However, also in California, Humboldt County passed a very interesting and quite possibly revolutionary initiative, something called Measure T. What it does is prohibit corporations from outside the county from donating to political campaigns and ballot measures inside the county. In other words, what it does basically is strip the citizenship rights of corporations who have in the past been allowed by courts because they have the rights of individuals to have the rights as campaign donors of individuals, meaning that they can donate anywhere they want. Humboldt County is not going to allow that, and we'll see where that goes in the courts, but it's definitely a good thing for them. We also had a guy named John Tester, real progressive in Montana, win against a centrist Democrat in the Democratic primary there. He goes on to take Senator Conrad Burns, who's a very embattled incumbent Republican senator in Montana because of his associations with Jack Abramoff. So a potential there to get a progressive Democrat into office from the state of Montana, of all places. And we talked last week about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s expose on what happened in 2004 in the state of Ohio and the role of Secretary of State Kim Blackwell now running for governor. Mr. Blackwell was at it again this week, promulgating rules that makes it very, very difficult, in fact, quite possibly felonious for people to register new voters in the state of Ohio, where the new voter registrations are running heavily Democratic, particularly in urban areas. So people are up in arms about that. It's basically Blackwell is trying to deny the vote to a great many people by suppressing voter turnout in 2006.
All right. And then in Congress or the Senate, Murtha, who aspires to move to a leadership position.
Yeah, that's in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. Jack Murtha, the anti-war critic from Ohio, announced that he wants to become the new majority leader if the Democrats take back the Senate the House in November. That would mean Nancy Pelosi would become Speaker of the House. The number two position would be the House Majority Leader, the leader of the Democrats, and that's that's what Murtha wants. It would be an open seat right now. His main competition is Steny Hoyer, who's very much a centrist DLC-type Democrat that Murtha has clashed quite a bit with in the past, especially on Iraq.
Well, you just mentioned Iraq, and let's jump to international. Met plenty of developments there, as there are every week.
Yeah, well, the big news, of course, was the killing of Zarqawi, which unfortunately is getting a lot of really appalling media attention in this country, because the whole Bush administration spin of this being a major victory and a turning point, what does this make it about turning point or turning the corner number 10 or so, it's not going to change anything on the ground in Iraq. Yeah, Zarqawi was a nasty dude. He killed a lot of people who didn't deserve to be killed. Of course, you could say the same thing about George Bush, I suppose. But, it, you know, in this case, nobody, aside from a few jihadists, is really going to mourn his death. But, number one, there's plenty more jihadists where he came from. And, you know, in many ways, the Bush administration invented him. They originally invented him as the fictitious link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein in 2003. He used that as his street cred to actually recruit jihadists to his cause, and he became what they had already insisted he was. But with him gone, somebody else will step in to fill the breach. There's plenty of candidates, and we just don't know what the name is yet, but we'll find it out soon. That being said, the jihadist movement is a very, very small part of the insurgency in Iraq. It's mostly nationalists. That being said, the violence in Iraq right now is not primarily coming from attacks on American and British troops. It's primarily coming from sectarian strife from the civil war that Bush's folly has launched. And for people who doubt that, I recommend a very good article that came out earlier this week on Tuesday by Patrick Coburn that appeared in Counterpunch. It's called something like Bloodbath Beyond the Green Zone, and what it talks about is the reality on the ground in rural Iraq, places especially outside Baghdad that aren't being reported, where the violence is almost all due to death squads and assassinations by competing Shiite and Sunni groups. It makes for very grim reading, and really ought to disabuse anybody of the notion that the assassination of Zarqawi is going to change anything on the ground in Iraq.
Patrick Coburn being one of the few reporters, a handful of reporters in Iraq that actually leaves the Baghdad hotel to actually do reporting.
Yeah, and he's very experienced in the region and in Iraq, and you know, knows the language and the people and has a lot of contacts, and he does get around, and his reporting is really quite invaluable. At the same time, we had a couple of other interesting developments. We had one of the biggest, in fact, Sunni party in Iraq called the Iraqi Islamic Party, saying that you know, in addition to Haditha, in addition to Ishaqi, which we talked about last week, that there had also been some 29 Iraqi civilians that had been murdered in May by the United States, and they in various places, in small, you know, numbers, groups, a few here, a few there, had all been killed universally by American airstrikes. But that accusation did not get any press whatsoever in the United States, of course. And then we also had the first officer in the U.S. military, a person named Lieutenant Aram Watada, who refused to deploy to Iraq. Mr. Watada is getting a lot of national attention for this refusal, and he happens to have been stationed in and come from Fort Lewis right here in the state of Washington. So we can be proud of him for that.
All right, moving along, Afghanistan.
Yeah, interesting development there this week. We had 23 Afghans released from Bagram, the Air Force base north of Kabul, where there's a pretty notorious prison. There's about 500 Afghans that have been held in detention, you know, indefinitely, without trial, without charges, without access to lawyers or human rights monitors, etc. And those Afghans turned around and started talking to the media and were complaining of maltreatment at the hands of the Americans at a new prison that had been built there. So, you know, keep an eye on that, because the mistreatment of prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan is apparently continuing.
And Iran.
Yeah, we had a development today, in fact, Iran time anyway. The foreign minister there saying that Iran will make a counteroffer to the United States offer to negotiate that came out of the Bush administration about 7-10 days ago. So there's some movement on that, and these two governments full of hardliners may actually try and sit down and negotiate. What a concept.
All right. And moving along, the Pentagon looks like it wants to make its manuals a little bit lighter, at least when it comes to Geneva Conventions.
Yeah, several human rights things this week. The Pentagon announced a proposal, which is getting some flack from the State Department and Congress, that it wants to omit from its new Army Field Manual on interrogation the Geneva Convention's ban on humiliating and degrading treatment of prisoners. There's going to be no mention in the new manual that that's a bad thing, so that people can go right ahead and do their humiliating and degrading treatment, even though it violates the Geneva Conventions. We also had at Guantanamo the revelation that there are now it's now up to 89 hunger strikers out of the 500 or so prisoners that are remaining. That's up from three only a few weeks ago. So apparently, in response to the so-called prisoner riot there a few weeks ago and the fallout from that, there have been a number of hunger strikes launched that people aren't really hearing about. And then finally, the Council of Europe issued a pretty damning report on CIA rendition this week. What they did is they went through and got flight plans from various air traffic control towers of flights that they track all over the world. And what they came up with was what they called a spider web, basically, of CIA routes of rendition flights, including they came to the conclusion that there are at least two secret bases in Eastern Europe, one in Poland and one in Romania, but that they're spread all over the world. And this is something that the CIA is doing with the knowledge and the complicity of governments not only in Europe, but again, all over the world.
Mm. All right. And quickly, South Korea, U.S. looking at making some trade arrangements there?
Yeah, this is a scary one that didn't get any attention this week, but again, we should pay attention. Bush administration wants to launch a new NAFTA-style agreement, this one with South Korea, and there's enormous opposition to that. If you recall at the last WTO meetings in Hong Kong, it was the farmers and activists from South Korea that raised the most havoc there in protests, and you can be sure that in South Korea there will be a lot of opposition to this proposed free trade agreement. Whether it gets any attention in the United States, well, that's for us to work on.
All right, and quickly, email from a listener, Nicholas Hart, regarding Jack Murtha. Murtha is not anti-war. He wants to redeploy troops in the region around Iraq and increase the use of bombing against the people of Iraq. In short, he wants to rescue U.S. imperialism in the Middle East, not end U.S. intervention there.
I basically agree. He is anti the war as it is now being fought. He has said that he wants to move troops over the horizon and get them out of Iraq, which actually would be a vast improvement over where they are now. But he does want to deploy them elsewhere in the Middle East and maintain hegemony in the region. That's absolutely true. At the same time, he's been intensely critical of how the Bush administration has prosecuted the war, and it is thought that he speaks for a lot of the top brass in the Pentagon when he does that. So, fair point. Good point.
All right. Events.
Yeah. The big one, of course, this week is that President Bush is coming to Medina on Friday morning to have a nice fundraising event on behalf of Representative Dave Reichert, the freshman congressman running for re-election and claiming that he is a moderate and not very close to the Bush administration. Well, he's got a spirited challenge from Darcy Berner on his hands. Looks like it'll be a close election. So who does he turn to? That guy that he doesn't really have very much in common with, President Bush, who very few congresspeople are even asking for help right now because Bush is so low in the polls. But Reichert has not really been publicizing this visit because he doesn't necessarily want the association with Bush because he's so bad in the polls, but he does want the money from Bush's big roller supporters. So that's what this visit is all about. There will be a protest of it. There's at least one that has been called for 8:30 with a march as close as they can get to Medina. I'm sure there will be other people just aligning the route of 520 and the exit and trying to get Bush's attention one way or the other as things get organized this week.
talking once again, as we do every week, with Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a free publication that comes out every couple of weeks. You can find it at bookstores and cafes and the King County Library System and all the other places where you find free periodicals around town. We are also on the web, although much to our annoyance and frustration, the technical problems we've been having with our blog over the last month, 6 weeks, have culminated this week in the whole thing, site that and server that it's based on being down. So our apologies for that. But the main site is still up and running. It has the current issue. It has all our back issues. It's at www.eatthestate.org. And we'll get the blog up again as soon as we can. And if you have comments, feedbacks, tips, you'd like to volunteer, you like or hate what you've heard, anything like that, we always welcome your feedback and contact. Give our voicemail a ring at area code 206-719-6947.